On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast.
And I'm Tom Hall. This is Marilyn Morning.
Today's program marks the beginning of a series that we hope over the coming year will advance the conversation about inequality in the Baltimore region. It's called The Lines Between Us.
You'll hear conversations, personal stories, and reported pieces about differences in opportunity, in housing, in employment, in education, in the criminal justice system, in all facets of life in our region.
We'll examine how factors like race and class played into those divisions in the past and what the dynamics are today. In a few minutes, we'll hear about one local man's experience growing up in Northwest Baltimore during the height of the Civil Rights Movement as African Americans began to move into that mostly Jewish quadrant of the city.
First, an essay from Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan, who came up with the idea for this series.
So the federal government did this thing in the Baltimore region where they essentially said, and said officially, here are the nice parts of town, and here are the parts of town you should avoid. This was in the 1990s. It wasn't the first time the federal government had done this. In the 1930s, the government's Homeowners Loan Corporation created a map. It showed the relative riskiness of lending in different areas. It correlated closely with the racial and ethnic makeups of neighborhoods. Black neighborhoods were rated very poorly. This time, in the 90s, it was HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. They had decided that, okay, maybe creating concentrated pockets of poverty by building high-rise public housing projects in disadvantaged neighborhoods wasn't going to work. So they knocked the high-rises down. And they moved residents, who were poor and mostly black, to other neighborhoods. Turns out most of those neighborhoods were poor and segregated, which means, if you look at the data, higher crime, fewer jobs, below average schools, they were just as far from opportunity as they had been in the projects. So, somebody filed suit. HUD ended up starting a program to move these former public housing residents to, quote, communities of opportunity. HUD actually defines communities of opportunity. It's right there in Section 4, Subsection C2 of the Settlement Agreement. And they got someone to make a map to show where the opportunities were, and where they weren't. If you pay attention to race and class in this region, you can probably picture this map in your mind, and it'd probably be pretty accurate. The lines on that map, they are the lines between us. The lines that show disparities in opportunity. We'll have the map on our website, linesbetweenus.org. Take a look. See if you live in one of these communities of opportunity. If I had to guess, I'd say most public radio listeners do. I thought I did, but looking at the map here, it turns out that I do not live in a community of opportunity. However, if I just walk east from my house for 30 seconds, I'm in the very bottom corner at the very edge of one of the very few communities of opportunity in Baltimore City. That's my first child. He'll be 3 months old on Monday. He lives with my wife and me in our community of opportunity, or at least very proximal opportunity. One day, he'll be a white man. When he's my age, he'll be a white man in a country that is majority minority, where white people will be less than 50% of the population. Among babies his age, that's already the case. And who knows what the economic landscape will be by then, whether inequalities of income and wealth will increase or decrease. But as much as race, class, and even gender dynamics will change as he gets older, my guess is that being a white male, particularly in Baltimore, will still mean differences in opportunity for him. Just a mile to the west of us, further into a vast stretch of communities of low opportunity, just down Union Avenue and up Druid Hill Drive over into Park Heights, say, parents will still be giving their children the talk. The talk about interacting with police and white people who might have unfairly low expectations of them. About the shooting of Trayvon Martin. About why this city is the way it is. What will my talk with my son be like? What will I tell him about why this city is the way it is? And, of course, where are we going to send him to school? This series is a chance for people in the community, and civic leaders and elected officials, for everyone to talk across the lines about why this region is the way it is, to talk about how it got that way, and about what people are doing to erase lines of class, race, and other factors to build community and opportunity in their place. We'll start with housing, and then we'll get into employment, education, the criminal justice system, health, and many other facets of social life in the region. We're just starting the conversation. We hope you will take it to new levels in your neighborhoods, your schools, your churches, your workplaces. We're hoping you'll use our website, linesbetweenus.org, as a central place to have that conversation. We'll post our on-air stories there, as well as the stories you tell us, and we'll have data and maps and other resources about inequality in the region. Starting this series, like having a child, is an act of hope, a reconciling of the past with the possibility of a better world in the future. All of the children in the Baltimore region have promise, but promise means nothing without opportunity. Let's talk about where those opportunities are and why.
Maryland Morning Senior Producer Lawrence Lanahan. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast.
And I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to the first episode of The Lines Between Us, Maryland Morning's year-long series exploring inequality in the Baltimore region, airing every Friday at 9 on 88.1 WYPR. The first few weeks of the series will focus on housing. The patchwork of neighborhoods we know in our region today was partly a result of government policies and the practices of banks and other institutions over the course of decades. It is a patchwork visibly divided by race and class.
That patchwork has changed over time. Jews from Baltimore's east side began moving en masse into the northwest section of the city during the first half of the 20th century. In the 1960s, African Americans moved into the quarter in large numbers. As society changed around the children of these neighborhoods during the 1960s, they looked to their parents to help them understand. Pikesville resident Sheldon Kaplis was one of those children. He told Lawrence Lanahan this story about his father.
I'm Sheldon Kaplis. I grew up in Baltimore, and the story is about my father. Joseph Kaplis worked for the post office, and in addition had a second job in those days as an insurance underwriter. And my father was a very quiet man, and he was a man of his time. He was not emotional, didn't put his arm around you or, you know, something like that. But he was a very kind person, and we knew that. The one thing that I remember about my father, they opened the new post office, which is now the old post office, on Fayette Street during his lifetime. My father did tours, and we went down for the tour. My father took us around for the tour, and all these people, white, black, women, would come up to my father, oh, this is your family, your father's a wonderful guy, you know. So I learned so much about him in a tour of an hour. And when his colleagues talked to me, that's what his colleagues said. His colleagues said, your father always had a kind word for people. He was funny, always had a smile on his face, just believed in fairness. There was a restaurant called Mandel's, which was a well-known hangout. And occasionally, my father would take us to breakfast there on Sunday morning. And one Sunday, my mother and brother and I are saying to my father, can we go to Mandel's for breakfast? And my father said, no, we're not going to Mandel's anymore. And we just looked at him. And we said, why not? And my father said, they don't allow black people in. And until they do, we're not going there anymore. We didn't know that they had started to picket Mandel's. That was my father. You know, not a lot of fanfare, not a lot of explanation, just that, no, we're not going there anymore until they fix it. That was my father. Unfortunately, he died when I was 13, and he died of a heart attack. And in our religion, the Jewish religion, we sit Shiva after the funeral, and people come and pay their respects. We lived in a row house in northwest Baltimore. I shared a bedroom with my brother. There were probably, I would say, 40 or 50 people in the house. It was crowded, and the doorbell rang, and I opened the door, and there were two African-American gentlemen at the door, which was very unusual. This is 1964. And they asked if this was the Kaplis residence, and I said it was. And they said, we worked with your father. Can we come in? And I said, of course. And they came in, and they said, we'd like to meet your mother. And I said, sure. And, you know, the house got very quiet. People are looking at two African-American gentlemen. And so the gentlemen went over to my mother and introduced themselves. And they said, Mrs. Kaplis, we worked with your husband. And my mother nodded, you know, I mean, she was pretty sad. And they said, we wanted to tell you what a wonderful man your husband was. And it brought a smile to my mother. And then they said, we want you to know that without your husband, we wouldn't own our homes. And my mother looked at them. And I looked at them. I didn't really know what they meant. I was 13. And they said, he co-signed our loans. And my mother started to cry. I didn't realize the impact of that until obviously years later. I mean, I knew it was quite a thing. My mother did not know. My father was like that. My father did the right thing because he thought it was the right thing to do, not because he wanted any recognition or accolades, and he probably didn't want to worry my mother. And again, only years later did I realize that if one of those gentlemen had defaulted, my father would have been responsible for the for those funds, and you know, we didn't have much. It's interesting to me because I think that black-white relationships are not good now. So it's not just black-Jewish relationships. I think certainly the high water point was the civil rights movement, because it seemed like almost everyone in the Jewish community was for civil rights for African Americans. And I guess it was a shared value of where we came from and where they were coming from. We like to think that it's done. We like to think that the fact that we've passed a lot of laws and you know, done certain things, that it's over. And I think if you open your eyes, and I think exposure is so much of this, I mean, I still see so much of the white community, even those that work downtown, the only African Americans they ever see are those who are on the street corner begging. They go to their offices and they go home. So many are not involved in the community and don't want to be. It's easier to close your eyes, in a sense. It is. If you don't see, then it's not there. But I also think that in the long run, if we don't educate people, if we don't give people the skills to get good jobs, then the country will suffer. I mean, to me, it's about enlightened self-interest. You know, if you want a healthy community, that's how you build a healthy community.
Pikesville resident Sheldon Kaplis. He told his story to our senior producer, Lawrence Lanahan. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. Stick around for a Baltimore story from Gilbert Sandler and headlines from NPR News.
And when we return, a conversation about Sheldon Kaplis' story and the history of residential segregation in the Baltimore region with Antero Pietola, the author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City, and James Crockett, an 87-year-old African-American man who started practicing real estate in Baltimore in the mid-1950s.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're continuing the first episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region. Before the break, we heard a story from Sheldon Kaplis, 61 years old, a Jew who grew up in Northwest Baltimore. He was 13 when his father died in 1964. It was only then that he discovered his father had co-signed home loans for two African-American men. I want to understand how the black family and the Jewish family in that story got to that point. Why, in 1964, did a Jewish man need to co-sign a loan for a black man to buy a house? With us now are two people who can shed some light on that. Antero Pietola, a former Baltimore Sun reporter, spent a decade researching and writing the book, Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
And also with us is James Crockett. He lives in the West Baltimore neighborhood of Ashburton. In the 1950s, he was one of the first African Americans in the Baltimore City Fire Department. And in the mid-50s, he became a real estate broker. Welcome to the show.
Thank you ever so much.
Now, before we get to the question I posed about the mid-60s, let's start a little further back. Antero Pietola, Baltimore City Council passed a notorious residential segregation bill in 1910. Is that part of this puzzle?
It is part of the puzzle. And the 1910 law was remarkable in that Baltimore became the first city in the United States that's through a city council ordinance required that every neighborhood be segregated by race. And so basically what happens at the same time is also that neighborhoods become more and more stratified, even white neighborhoods. And so this is the time. From 1913 on, Roland Park Company, a leading real estate developer, decided that no Jews could own property in any of the communities that Roland Park developed: Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland, original Northwood. And that lasted from 1913 until the late 1950s, when the Roland Park Company went out of business.
But I thought the Supreme Court nullified the Baltimore Ordinance in 1917.
The Supreme Court nullified a Louisville ordinance that was patterned after the Baltimore Ordinance. But it was on the basis of these kinds of restrictive covenants that were not laws, but were contracts, private contracts among homeowners, that neighborhoods were kept segregated, or they excluded other people that homeowners did not want, in many cases Jews and African Americans, in some other cases Italians. Or people of Middle Eastern origin.
There are words that we've come to associate with that first half of the 20th century in housing: redlining. What role did redlining play and blockbusting?
Well, redlining is the operative concept here, because that explains why people could not get loans. In 1937, the federal government prepares maps, real estate maps, for 239 American cities, including Baltimore. And those maps, there are different colors applied to neighborhoods that the federal government sees at good real estate risks and neighborhoods that are bad real estate risks. And so there are two so-called good colors, green and blue. And what is common to both of those categories is that they are mostly Anglo-Saxon homeowners. And the federal government requires that these two categories are neighborhoods that have restrictive covenants, barring African Americans and Jews.
James Crockett, am I right that you were born in the mid-20s?
That's correct, in Baltimore.
Where?
University Hospital. At that time, they called it Green Street Hospital. Green and Baltimore Street.
Okay.
University Hospital of Maryland.
Oh, okay. And you lived where growing up?
I lived in South Baltimore. It was called Haw Street. It was only two blocks of it. I lived around the corner from Babe Ruth in the 20s.
Okay, so that leads me to believe it was not an entirely black neighborhood, or am I wrong?
Was not an entirely black neighborhood. Blacks and whites lived together, and during the Depression, they got along fine. They supported each other.
Antero Pietola, is that unusual?
On one side, we have a city that is a pioneering city in racial segregation. On the other hand, Baltimore really never became totally segregated. And one of the reasons was that until the riots of 1968, there would be a relatively good number of lingering whites in neighborhoods that had changed racially. And it was only after the riots that then the atmosphere became so tense that this kind of mixing almost totally ended.
James, when did you first buy a home?
I bought my first home in 1954 on Coco Lane. It's in the Panway section on Grands Falls Parkway.
And what kind of restrictions were there on where you could look for a home?
It was a Jewish neighborhood. It's a strange pattern. In Baltimore, Jewish people followed Italian neighborhoods. When the Jews moved in, the Italians moved out. And by the same token, when blacks moved into Jewish neighborhoods, the Jews moved out. So this was a unique neighborhood developed by the Panish brothers, Leon Panish and Stanley Panish.
Did you feel restricted in where you could look for a home?
No, not at that time, because Baltimore leapfrogged neighborhoods. African Americans cannot describe blockbusting, because if you're looking for a decent home and you can afford it, you move into that neighborhood. So you're not doing anything purposely to break the block. You're only looking for a home.
Andrew, does that make sense to you?
It does. And so let me take us back to the story that we heard at the beginning and to the kinds of extraordinary situations that developed in this kind of climate where there was black hunger for home ownership and yet no lending going on. There was a jewelry store operator on Saratoga Street downtown, a very well-known man named Louis Bock, who also later in his career ended up owning Marconi's restaurant, one of the finest restaurants in the city. Well, in the 1930s, he had operated a loan office on Pennsylvania Avenue, which was the segregation era's premium black retail district. And somehow there, he had gotten to know Lily Mae Jackson, who was the matriarch of Baltimore's civil rights movement, who headed the NAACP in Baltimore. And for decades, the Bock family fronted for Mrs. Jackson, buying property for her and financing her. And I don't know how this relationship really, really evolved, what the starting point was. But this type of thing happened, and so we saw it in the capitalist situation.
You say you don't know what the starting point was. What do you think the motivation was?
Well, the motivation may have been a mixture of lots of complicated things. It may have been sympathy. It may have been solidarity. It may have been profit-making.
In addition to that, when African Americans graduated college in Baltimore, they could either go into teaching or into the post office. And when you went into the post office, if you were a clerk, you became very familiar with the people on the floor with you. And Mr. Kaplan's probably gravitated to these two men that talked to his wife, and he showed them how to buy stock, because most of the clerks in the post office read the stock market every day before they start casing the mail, so they became very good friends. So it could be a common event for him to develop a friendship with them and decide to co-sign for a mortgage.
This is Marilyn Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with James Crockett, who worked in real estate during the Civil Rights Movement, and Antero Pietola, author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Antero Pietola, the housing crisis we're living through today, where do you see the roots of it?
I think that it all goes down to the redlining. That was an official government act. It and the really truly important point about redlining is that by separating every city into four color categories that presumably indicated which were safe neighborhood for lending and unsafe neighborhood for lending, the federal government basically said that the so-called unsafe areas still might be good for some loan making, but that it would have to be made on terms different from the so-called safe areas. And this is the moment in 1937 when the federal government gives its tempo approval on a two-tier lending system in this kind of formalized form and continues to exist today. One market for credit-worthy people, often white, another speculative market operated by the blockbusters, and then in later years through subprime lending, in which most of the subprime loans made on different terms from the so-called good loans were again made to buyers who belong to minority groups, blacks and Hispanics.
Redline continues today. They use a different name. It's called a FICO score. Anybody that want to buy a house today, when you get your credit report, they have two qualifications on there. And what the banks do, if one qualification is 625, that's your credit score, and another is 685 or 700. Once black people go there with those qualifications, they elevate them into a new category. The FICO score was a vehicle to determine the likelihood of people buying houses that the banks would foreclose on. And then the banks decided to use that as the barometer to qualify people for buying homes. So the red line exists today, but just with a different name. That's how it works.
Let me ask this. The housing crisis that we've been through or still are in, do you think it's going to have an impact on the pattern, the racial pattern of where people live in the Baltimore area?
Well, it is really very unpredictable as to what impact it will have in the next 10 years for a couple of reasons. Number one, the flight now out of Baltimore is not white flight. It is African-American flight. And it is, you go to the Owings Mills Liberty Road section of Baltimore County and you see it, and you see how big churches are moving, the institutions are moving. One of the biggest churches in the city, New Psalmist, just inaugurated a new sanctuary. It is right on the city-county line. That's where the population is going. And so the tragedy of Baltimore is that I cannot think of a single African-American neighborhood that is seen as fashionable. Ashburton, where Jim lives, is a wonderful neighborhood with lots of value and good qualities. But number one, whites are not interested in it, which would not be tragic at all, except that the black professionals are no longer interested in Ashburton either. That is their parents and grandparents' time. They have experienced Ashburton. They are not interested. So the tragedy of Ashburton today is that here is a wonderful neighborhood and there is no demand.
Absolutely. We have a lot of houses available in Ashburton. Real estate people sell the city. They sell the hospitals, the churches, the schools, in addition to the property. The location of transportation. We sell the city. We know what's going on in all of the neighborhoods because we drive through them and we talk to people. So your question would be something like this. It's a matter of education. If you educate the African Americans in the neighborhood where they live, to appreciate the neighborhoods and to take care of the neighborhoods, the entire city of Baltimore would be a wonderful place to live.
And not segregated?
And not segregated. Let's take Butcher's Hill, for instance. You know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
It's a big change over down in Butcher's Hill. White people coming in, buying mm-hmm. houses, and they get along fine.
And that's where the contrast between Ashburton and some of the fashionable neighborhoods is so striking. While Ashburton is begging for home buyers, Roland Park has opened up now, and in Roland Park, the more diversified it has become, the more welcoming it has become to Jewish buyers or African American buyers, the more successful it has become. It is not that you are going to sell your $600,000 home in Roland Park overnight in today's market conditions, but you are going to sell it. Whereas a house listed at $250,000 in Ashburton has no takers.
None whatsoever.
And yet they are very much comparable in certain types of houses are very similar. This is how segregated the city is today. But this kind of segregation has been breaking up in the suburbs. Now, are those suburbs resegregating? That is the question.
They are resegregating.
And that's a topic for another day. I appreciate you both talking to us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
James Crockett and Antero Pietola.
More information, including a link to Antero Pietola's book, Not in My Neighborhood, at WIPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Thanks for listening to this first episode of The Lines Between Us, WIPR's new year-long series examining inequality in the Baltimore region. I'm Sheila Cast.
And I'm Tom Hall. At the Lines Between Us website, we hope to share your stories of inequality. Have housing policies and practices in the region influenced your opportunities? Do you know of people or institutions that are doing a good job overcoming inequality?
Share your story at linesbetweenus.org. You can also see data maps at the website that illustrate the landscape of inequality in the region. Again, linesbetweenus.org.
It's Maryland Morning. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great week.